場の皆様、オンラインでご参加の皆様、今日は本当にお忙しい中をありがとうございました。7月から笹川で常任理事をしております金原でございます。よろしくお願いいたします。本日は笹川 の平和財団の日米グループというのが主催をした会合でございます。ゲストを今ご紹介ございましたけれども、アメリカからですね、ジョン・ホプキンス大学サイスのハル・ブランド先生です。最近書かれたですね、デンジャーゾーンという本で大変有名になられました。中国はピークアウトをして国力が落ちるときが実は一番危ないんじゃないかということで警鐘を鳴らされて、日本でも大きな影響のあるあった方でございます。もう一人ザック・クーパーさんですね、私たちの友達で長いこと日本の友人で、アジア安全保障日米同盟の権威でございます。今日このお二人にですね、いろいろとお話を伺ってまいりたいと思います。私は前安倍政権の時に7年間官邸におりましたけれども、高見沢さんがいらっしゃってますが、一緒にいたんですけれども、安倍政権立ち上がった時のですね、中国の GDP は日本と実は同じだったんですよね。あまり変わらなくて、中国って大きくなったねと言ってたんですけれども、あれよあれよという前にですね、日本の3倍の大きさになりまして、アメリカ 75% であります。一番こうアメリカと中国の大国間競争というのは戦争ではなくて、2人でですね、2国間で国際社会のリーダーシップを競争して奪い合っていくということでございますけれども、うちは横に台湾がございますので、台湾ですね、これは一つの中国で、どちらが正統政府かということで議論してまいりましたけれども、これは私たち の根本的なスタンスは現状維持であります。台湾海峡の平和と安定、これを維持してこられたのは、ひとえにですね、アメリカの国力が圧倒的に大きかったというのがあります。今これが大国間競争の中で揺らいできている。この中でどうやってですね、台湾海峡の平和と安定を維持していくか、でこのアメリカと中国の大国間競争をですね、どうやって導いていくかということについて、今日は素晴らしい議論が聞けるのではないかと期待をしております。モデレーターは慶応大学の森先生にお願いいたします。じゃあ皆様どうぞよろしくお願いいたします。
それでは本日のシンポジウムを始めさせていただきたいと思います。慶応義塾大学の森と申します。よろしくお願いいたします。本日は米中対立の行方と国際安全保障の変化ということで、米中関係については昨今さまざまな媒体を通じて議論が非常に盛んになっておりますけれども、この米中関係、非常に多面的なものになりました。多面的と申しますのは、さまざまな分野で競争関係というものが生じているということが言えようかと思います。軍事面で、それから経済産業分野、もちろん先端技術で、それから価値や、体制間競争といったような言葉も聞かれますし、地政学的な影響力、さらには国際ルールや、制度といったものをめぐってアメリカと中国が、しのぎを削り合うというようなことが、起こってきていると。だいたいオバマ政権の第2期目ぐらいから、アメリカと中国との関係というものは緊張含みになってきたというのが、昨今大体定着した見方だろうと思います。で、本日は先ほどご紹介ありましたブランズ先生とクーパーさんをお迎えして、この米中関係、今後、特に安全保障面ですね、それから外交面についてフォーカスをして議論を進めてまいりたいと思います。で、先ほど金原常務からもお話ありました通り、ブランズさんは最近デンジャーゾーンという本を出版されまして、いわゆるその台湾有事をめぐるさまざまなリスクがどういうドライバーに基づいてそういうものが発生してくるのか、高まってくるのかということを議論されましたので、まず最初にブランズさんから20分ほどお話をいただきたいと思っています。で、それに続きまして、クーパーさんから約10分ぐらいで別のアングルからですね、この米中対立というものについて、主として外交面ということになるかと思いますけれども、議論コメントをしていただくという形にしたいと思います。で、それに続きまして、恐縮ですけれども、私と、パネリストのお二人との間でいわゆるモデレーテッドディスカッションということで若干の議論をさせていただいて、私の方からいくつか、パネリストのお二人に質問をさせていただいて、最後の、約20分25分ぐらいお時間をいただきまして、フロアの皆様から の質問をお二人にぶつけてみたいというふうに思っております。そのような形で本日は進行してまいりたいと思いますので、よろしくお願いいたします。それでは早速ですけれども、ブラン先生、お話の方よろしくお願いいたします。
Thank you very much for that introduction, and thanks so much to the Sasakawa Peace Foundation and everyone on the team for hosting this event. It's a real pleasure to have the opportunity to spend a little bit of time with you this afternoon. And it's a very timely subject, the future of U.S.-China rivalry. I'm going to spend my time making the argument about why much of what many people in Washington, at least, have thought about the U.S.-China rivalry is wrong, why that rivalry is rapidly approaching its most dangerous point, and what the United States and Japan and its friends can do to prevent competition from spiraling into conflict in the Taiwan Strait. And so I think I'll start by describing what I would consider what for many years had been the conventional wisdom on the U.S.-China rivalry. And this could be expressed through this idea of the Thucydides trap, this notion that when you have an established power that is challenged by a rising power, war becomes most likely when the rising power overtakes the established power, tension spike, and conflict results. And this has often been applied to the U.S.-China relationship in recent years. And to some degree, this is an accurate characterization of what is happening in the U.S.-China relationship. Clearly, to some degree, tensions between the U.S. and China today are rooted in changing power dynamics between the two countries. China is just vastly more powerful than it was a quarter century ago or half a century ago. It has greater ability to challenge the status quo in ways that seem to threaten the United States. If the People's Liberation Army had not become so much more impressive today than it was a quarter century ago, we would not be witnessing such high tensions in the Taiwan Strait. But the argument that my co-author Michael Beckley and I made in the book that was referenced is that it's wrong to think that China is going to overtake the United States as the world's leading power, that there will be a hegemonic transition, as political scientists might put it. In fact, it's wrong to think about China as a rising power at all. China should really be thought of as a peaking power. It's a country that has become very strong, strong enough to destabilize the existing international system, but one that's actually going to struggle to overtake the United States economically and militarily in the years to come. To some degree, that is good news, but it's also bad news in the sense that revisionist powers, that is, powers that want to change the way the international system work, often become most dangerous when they peak and start to decline. And so the implication of this is that we shouldn't think of the U.S.-China relationship as a superpower marathon or a 100-year struggle or anything like that. The U.S.-China relationship competition may persist for some time, but we really need to be thinking about it as more of a decade-long sprint to shore up the status quo, to shore up the balance of power, particularly in the Western Pacific. So let me go into a little bit greater detail on that. The first point I would make is that China's rise is real. If you look back at the degree of economic growth that China has experienced since the reform and opening period began around 1978, it's astounding. The military buildup that growth has enabled has been referred to as the biggest peacetime military buildup since World War II by U.S. Officials. And so China has become vastly stronger economically and militarily than it was in a prior era, and this has allowed it to articulate and pursue some very big ambitions. And when I think about what the Chinese Communist Party wants, I think there are basically four things that party wants. It wants to maintain a hammerlock on power within China. It wants to maintain regime security. It wants to make China whole again by reclaiming territories and waters that in the Chinese narrative were part of the country since time immemorial but were wrenched away from it when it was weak and divided in the 19th and early 20th centuries. It wants to achieve a sphere of influence encompassing much of the Asia-Pacific. And ultimately, by mid-century, it would like to be the most powerful country in the world, one with the ability to shape the international system in the 21st century as the United States shaped it in the 20th. And so those are significant ambitions, and in many ways, they are rooted on the premise that China will overtake the United States and what the Chinese might call comprehensive national power. The only problem is that China has started to encounter two very serious problems that will stand in the way of this. The first is economic stagnation. I think this argument was a bit more controversial when Mike Beckley and I first started making it about a year ago than it is now. Now you can't open up a newspaper without finding a story about massive youth unemployment in China, about the real estate bubble that seems to be in danger of popping, about the difficulties that China has had in energizing growth even after it ended its COVID zero policy. The argument I would make is that this is not a temporary set of problems. Chinese growth will wax and wane over the coming years, but China confronts a very serious structural problem, which is that all of the factors that enabled China to grow so explosively from the late 1970s to, say, the late 2000s have gone into reverse. And so China benefited from five very important tailwinds during this period, economically speaking. They've turned into headwinds now. And so if you're thinking about the Chinese economic miracle, it happened at the confluence of five key trends. The first was demographics. China had a population that was primed for productivity and prosperity because you had a huge working age population with relatively few young children or elderly parents to take care of. China was largely sufficient, self-sufficient, or nearly so, in many of the resources that were needed to energize industrial growth in the late 70s and 80s and after. China was pursuing more enlightened economic policies. As the reform and opening period began, market incentives were introduced in a more significant way. Technocratic expertise was empowered within aspects of the bureaucracy. And China became a socialist country with market characteristics, so to speak. The politics of China evolved in a somewhat more benign form. China was always, under the CCP, a deeply authoritarian regime, but it became a somewhat smarter form of authoritarianism after the death of Mao Zedong, after the emergence of something closer to collective rule during the reform and opening period. The CCP basically put in place a number of guardrails to guard against the type of policy mistakes that happened when you had one-man rule under Mao Zedong, and so you had a political system that was more conducive to economic growth as well. And then the fifth and final factor was that China just faced a much more welcoming world from the late 1970s onward than it had before. First, during the Cold War, during the late Cold War, when the United States viewed China as a tacit ally vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, and then after the end of the Cold War, the United States and also other major democracies, Japan foremost among them, were rooting for Chinese economic growth, and they opened their markets to Chinese goods, they transferred technology to China, they helped China gain access to the World Trade Organization, and otherwise insert itself into the global economy. And when you put these five factors together, it was a very powerful package for economic growth. The challenge is that in each of these areas, these factors have turned around. And so whereas China once was cashing in on a demographic dividend, now it's staring down the barrel of one of the worst demographic collapses in peacetime history. By the end of this century, China's population may be half of what it is today. Even over the next 10 to 15 years, China is going to add significant numbers of retirees and lose significant numbers of working age individuals. That has historically been a formula for economic stagnation. China is running out of resources. It's running out of arable land and usable water. It's become highly dependent on energy that's imported over vulnerable supply lines. And so as a result of this, growth has just become much more expensive for China than it was two or three decades ago. Obviously, the economic reform program has stalled over the past 15 years. It's really gone into reverse. We're seeing this in a more accentuated way under Xi Jinping, as you increasingly see political cronies installed at the top of key enterprises. You see a more of an emphasis on political control as opposed to economic spontaneity. It's clear that China has been moving away from a reform agenda for some time. This relates to the fourth factor, which is that China's politics have become more authoritarian, perhaps even neo-totalitarian, than they have been at any time since Mao Zedong's death. You increasingly have a regime under Xi Jinping that is willing to sacrifice growth for a higher degree of political control and ideological mobilization. And then last but not least, the world is no longer so welcoming to Chinese growth and prosperity and influence as it was before. More and more countries, particularly the advanced democracies, see China as an economic and a geopolitical competitor. They're taking steps to wall off parts of their economies, their 5G telecommunications networks, from Chinese influence. For instance, the United States and other countries have started to introduce sanctions that are meant, whether the United States acknowledges this or not, to slow China's growth and innovation. And so if you add up these five factors, China is just going to have a much more difficult time in the coming decade and beyond growing at anything like the rates that China and the world became accustomed to during, say, the 30 years after the reform and opening period began. Up until about 2008, China was averaging double-digit annual GDP growth. For a decade after that, it was around 7 or 8%. Coming out of COVID, it's going to be markedly lower than that. It's not even clear that the Chinese economy will grow at all this year. So that's problem one. Problem two might be referred to as strategic encirclement. One of the remarkable things about China's rise is that it happened with so little international resistance, thanks largely to the allure of the Chinese market and also to the hide-and-bide strategy that China pursued under Deng Xiaoping and after. But since 2008, 2009, China has shifted towards a much more assertive strategy, and as China has pushed harder in its region and beyond, a growing group of countries has started to push back. I won't go into a lot of detail on this, but you can see it in what's happening in the US-Japan alliance. You can see it in what's happening in the various multilateral groupings that have come together around issues like the AUKUS coalition, the Quad, in the way that the Group of Seven and NATO are taking a greater interest in China, the way that the United States is deepening its relations with India, the ways that countries in the Indo-Pacific are deepening relations with each other as a way of creating more resilience to Chinese power. It's actually difficult to identify a single advanced democracy that China has not fundamentally alienated over the past 5 years. And so the days of easiest Chinese economic growth are behind it, just as the days of the easiest expansion of China's international influence are behind it. And so these are two very serious problems for China. They're going to make it very difficult for Xi Jinping to achieve the ambitions that he's laid out. The challenge, though, is that this doesn't necessarily make China less dangerous. And so when you think about countries that want to reorder the international system, historically, those countries become most dangerous, most risk-prone, not when they are confidently ascending, but when they worry that they've peaked and that they're beginning to decline. When they worry that the future will be worse than the present, that's when countries take bigger risks to try to seize and lock in gains while they still can. I think the best historical example of this is Germany prior to World War I. This is a country that had been rising for decades. It had made itself the foremost land power in Europe. It was building a navy to try to rival the Royal Navy. In doing so, it made a very powerful coalition of enemies, the Triple Entente, featuring France, Russia, and the United Kingdom. And so by the time 1914 comes around, Germany increasingly feared strategic encirclement, and increasingly feared that its competitors were going to start discriminating against it economically in ways that would make it harder for it to grow over time. And so Germany was going to find it more and more difficult to achieve its ambitions of becoming the preeminent power in Europe and gaining global influence if it didn't move quickly. And this was the mindset that produced extreme German risk-taking during the July crisis of 1914, when Germany essentially seized upon the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand from Austria-Hungary as a pretext to generate the crisis that led to World War I. There's a lot more that one can say about this history, but this is simply the analogy that I'd like to draw. And this is the situation that I worry about with respect to China today. China's economic power is stagnating. It's facing strategic encirclement, but the challenge is that countries don't peak in all dimensions at once. It takes time to translate economic power into military power, and you can continue spending money on your military even after your economic performance has peaked. And the challenge is that even as China peaks economically, it has not yet peaked militarily. And in some ways, it will be at its strongest position in the Western Pacific and in the Taiwan Strait in the latter part of this decade, in the late 2020s. This is when China's buildup and its current set of military reforms will be maturing. We know that Xi Jinping has told the People's Liberation Army to be ready for a Taiwan contingency by 2027, which is not to say that he has ordered it, but simply that he has told the PLA that should be a target in terms of readiness and preparation. But the challenge is that the military modernization programs that the United States is undertaking, that Taiwan is undertaking, to a lesser degree that Japan is undertaking and other countries are undertaking, will not really begin to bear fruit in a major way until the early 2030s. And so if you are sitting in Beijing, you're going to confront a situation in the late 2020s where the future looks increasingly dark economically and strategically, but there's a window of military advantage, a window of military opportunity to reorder the Western Pacific to your liking in the late 2020s. Historically, that's been a very volatile type of situation, and I worry it's the type of situation that could lead Xi Jinping to make bigger gambles to try to achieve some of the gains that he has articulated. So we shouldn't kid ourselves. If there is a war in the Western Pacific, it will be the worst thing that the world has experienced in many decades. The physical destruction will be intense for Taiwan and other countries. The economic destruction will make the disruptions that the Ukraine war have caused look minor by comparison. There will be a real risk of nuclear escalation if the United States and China find themselves at war. This will be a clash that may not end anytime soon because both sides will have incentives to keep fighting even after the initial rounds. And so once China has decided to attack Taiwan, all of the options are terrible for the United States, for Japan, for every country that has an interest in upholding peace and stability in the Western Pacific. And so the key is to think about whether it's possible to deter such a war, given that we don't want to fight it. I don't think this is an impossible task. An invasion of Taiwan would be one of the most complex military operations in history. It would probably be comparable in scale to the Allied invasion of France in 1944. Even a blockade would introduce some very serious difficulties from a Chinese perspective. And Xi Jinping presumably knows that if he tries this and fails, rather than affirming his power, it will undermine it, and it may put his own life at stake. And so China will want a reasonable certainty or a reasonable likelihood of a good outcome if it undertakes this conflict. And so what the United States and its friends need to do is simply introduce enough uncertainty in Xi Jinping's mind about whether an invasion of Taiwan will succeed at an acceptable cost that even a more risk-acceptant Xi declines to make that decision as the decade goes on. I think there are really six requirements of effective deterrence in the Taiwan Strait. For reasons of time, I won't go into a lot of detail on these things, but let me toss them out there as a means of generating discussion. The first, and in some ways the most difficult, Taiwan has to be able to protract the conflict. It has to be able to hold out until help arrives, and frankly, Taiwan has a long way to go in that respect. Two, the U.S. military has to be able to conduct a denial defense around Taiwan. It has to be able to break the blockade, sink the invasion fleet, basically prevent the PLA from generating enough combat power around Taiwan to achieve whatever China's political objectives are. Third, there will need to be an Indo-Pacific coalition that can assist the United States with the defense of Taiwan, but also raise the strategic price that China has to pay for attacking Taiwan by turning any conflict over Taiwan into a war that's not just between the United States, Taiwan, and China, but between China, the United States, Taiwan, and much of the region. Fourth, the ability to mount a global punishment campaign to inflict severe economic damage on China, perhaps through sanctions, perhaps through a blockade of China's energy supplies, but essentially to find ways of raising the economic and strategic price of the invasion so that even if it is successful, China will pay a terrible cost. Fifth, and perhaps most uncomfortably, I think the United States needs a credible ability to fight a limited nuclear war in the Western Pacific, not because the United States would be likely to use nuclear weapons first in a conflict over Taiwan. I don't think that is credible or plausible, but because the United States needs to be able to deter China from using its own growing nuclear arsenal to try to deter U.S. conventional intervention in a Taiwan conflict in the way that Vladimir Putin has tried to use Russia's nuclear arsenal to deter Western intervention in Ukraine. And then sixth and finally, reassurance is the necessary counterpart to deterrence, and so the United States and Taiwan and other countries will need to find a way of ensuring that it's clear that what they are simply trying to do is preserve the status quo in the Strait rather than putting Taiwan on the path to independence or some other political outcome that the CCP can't live with. I'm happy to talk about any of these issues in greater detail. The point I would simply make is that on each of these dimensions, all six of these dimensions, I think there has been real progress, even historic progress in some cases. And so if you look at the coalition building aspects of this strategy, the United States has done a number of things with key allies. Japan is the foremost among them over the past 2, 3, 5 years. And so you can actually see the outlines of a balancing coalition in the Indo-Pacific now in a way that I think was much more difficult to do 5 or 6 years ago. The challenge is that in each of these areas, I'm still not sure whether the U.S. and its friends have done enough to get ahead of the threat. That's true if you look at the shortfalls the United States faces in critical munitions. It's true if you look at the doubts that surround Taiwan's ability to withstand a Chinese assault and keep fighting even as the population absorbs quite a lot of punishment. That's true if you look at the question of whether the United States can succeed in signing other countries up for an economic punishment campaign and make that clear in advance of the invasion as a way means of deterring it. Again, there's a lot more we can talk about here, and perhaps we can get into the discussion. But the point I'd make is that there's been progress. My question is whether it's happening quickly enough to get ahead of this rapidly maturing threat. Thank you.
ブラウン先生ありがとうございました。非常に分かりやすく一定のディテールを交えながら簡潔にお考えをお話しいただけたのではないかと思います。それでは続いてクーパーさんからよろしくお願いいたします。
Wonderful. Well, Mori Sensei, thank you so much for having us here and to the Sasakawa Peace Foundation for hosting this wonderful event. It's great to be able to join my friend Hao here in Tokyo. As Hao's explained, I think his book is incredibly important, and it has shifted the debate, not just here, but also in Washington in some important ways. I just want to provide a couple of thoughts maybe about some of the challenges that the book raises. And I think the big challenge that I see is that I agree completely with how that the power dynamics are shifting. And it's evident to anyone that watches the Chinese economy today that the Chinese economy is not what it was 5 years, 10 years ago. What I wonder about, though, is whether the recognition of that power shift is the same as the actual power shift. In other words, I'm not sure that the United States or China see their perceptions of the power shift the same way that we would measure them as political scientists or historians. In other words, I think that both the United States and China think that the other side's system is failing. So from the American point of view, you can't read any American newspaper right now without finding a story every day about China's failures, right? The Chinese economy, the Chinese political system domestically, China's aggressive approach internationally, and Hao's laid this out beautifully in the book. We are convinced that the Chinese system is not succeeding at the moment, and therefore that the American system ultimately is going to be successful. And on the other side, I hear often from Chinese friends that they're entirely convinced that the American system is failing, right? That the American political system and political polarization suggests that actually the United States is the one who has dramatic problems. And to be candid, sometimes I watch our political system and I can't help but agree. But I think each of those players look at their own systems and think, actually, it's sort of working, right? So our friend Jude Blanchett describes how China looks at itself as a bodybuilder with a cold. So this is a short-term blip, not a long-term change. So China's still rising. It's just slowing down a little bit now, and then it'll pick pace back up soon. And I think for many Americans, we look at this political polarization, and we think, oh, well, we'll be over it next year. And we thought we would be over it in 2020, and we're not over it yet, but we'll be over it after the 2024 election. So in other words, I think we're both very confident that our power trends are actually more positive than everyone else thinks. And here, what I find particularly interesting is that in much of the rest of the world, I think they're convinced that both the United States and China are failing. So if you look at polling data in Southeast Asia of experts, most of the experts think that the US and China are both in trouble, not that the US or China is either of them is succeeding. And so this leads me to think that we need to be paying a bit more attention, not just to US-China dynamics, but to dynamics outside the bilateral relationship. And I know how you agree with this also. But let me just suggest three reasons why I think this is the case. So first, in the big picture, what we're seeing, as Hal said, is a shift towards what I would say is from unipolarity at, you know, the end of the Cold War to multipolarity. I don't think it's a bipolar system with the US and China. I think it's a multipolar one. We see this with the stance that India is taking on a whole range of issues, Europe's desire for more autonomy. I think we see this in how the BRICS as a group are responding, whether that's, you know, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, Indonesia. Many of these countries don't want to align with either the United States or China. They want autonomy. And what this means is that there's also a second trend, which is that we're shifting from alliances to alignment, right? So in the Cold War, we basically had two blocks. And now what we're finding is actually most countries want much more flexibility. And as a result, they want flexibility not just to be in one block all the time, but to shift from block to block depending on what the issue is at hand. So they may want to cooperate with China economically and cooperate with the US on security issues. They may want to take Chinese infrastructure investment, but work with the United States on technology. And so I think the old days of large alliance groupings like NATO are sort of going by the wayside, and we're seeing alignments as the new format that's getting much more attention. And then finally, I think there's a third trend that results from this, which is that we're seeing a transition from multilateralism to minilateralism. In other words, from large standing groups to smaller, much more flexible groups. And again, here the reason is that countries think that their interests differ greatly from issue to issue, and they may change over time. And therefore, they don't want to have to be aligned with large groups of countries that have to agree on everything. They want to have smaller groupings, right? So as Hal mentioned, we've now got AUKUS, we've got the CHIP4 grouping. We now, as of a few days ago, have a renewed trilateral arrangement with Japan, South Korea, and the United States. We've got the G7 and on and on. And so I think if you step back and you look at this arrangement, it suggests that actually, Hal's written a whole book on the differences between the Cold War and today. But one of the big differences is that I don't think we're entering some sort of bipolar competition between the US and China. I think for most of the world, this looks like a completely different type of setup. It's much more multipolar. It's going to lead to alignments rather than alliances. And it's going to lead to much more minilateralization, less multilateralization. So when you step back and look at it this way, I think the one big question I have for you, Hal, is whether the focus on sort of the bipolar nature of US-China power dynamics is the dominant factor, or whether actually what might be more important is the shifting nature of the order and the growing importance of third parties. So in other words, I'm not sure that the center of gravity in US-China competition is actually in Beijing or in Washington. I think the center of gravity is here in the rest of the region. And if that's right, then I wonder whether the power dynamics that you're talking about in the book are maybe the central driving factor, or might they be actually sort of a secondary one? So I'll leave it there and really look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Dr. Kupes, thank you very much for your very stimulating comments. So before I pitch my own questions to Halanzak, how would you like to respond to Zach's two excellent comments? He was mentioning about the recognition versus actual power dynamics, yeah. and also the structural shift, the center of gravity being in, among the third parties rather than the bilateral. So if you have any reactions to that.
Sure, yeah, I'd love to. And it's a great set of comments and a great set of questions. Let me try to do this relatively briefly. First, I would say that I think, Zach, you accurately flag a lot of the issues that'll be extremely important in a long competition between the U.S. and China, where I think you're right, that the center of gravity in a long competition between the U.S. and China are the alignments of third countries, right? But that's only the dominant issue if you succeed in deterring conflict in the coming years, right? And so the privilege of waging the competition you're talking about is the reward that we get for avoiding a war that will dominate everything else. On the question of sort of how, perception versus reality of power dynamics, let me just kind of tackle this from the Chinese side briefly. My read is that the Chinese are almost of two minds in terms of how they think about their role in the international system and the power dynamics that accompany that, which is not unusual. And so if you want to find evidence that the Chinese government thinks it's ascending vis-a-vis the United States, yep, easy to do, right? You can find lots of examples of Xi Jinping saying the East is rising, the West is declining, and so on and so forth. That said, you can also find, I would say, pretty intense Chinese anxiety around each of the issues that we've talked about. How did the Chinese respond to the trilat that you mentioned? They say there's an Asian NATO taking shape, right? They're very sensitive to these dynamics of encirclement. Xi Jinping will talk about China's rise, but he will also talk about how the United States is trying to strangle China and contain it and suppress it and warn of, very hard times ahead, heavy seas and dangerous storms and things of that nature. Sometimes you can glimpse the anxiety from what's not said. And so there was, in 2021, the Financial Times put out a news article indicating that China's population had actually declined in the year prior for the first time since the Great Leap Forward. And the National Statistics Bureau, basically put out a one-sentence statement saying the population continues to grow, right? And so there is clearly an understanding that there are real challenges around all these issues. And I think you'd actually see the same thing if you were to go back and look at some of the historical cases that we've talked about. And so if you look at Germany before World War I, depending on the day of the week, you can see the Kaiser talking about how Germany is going to put British naval supremacy on the ash heap of history, or talking about how the vice is closing around Germany. And I think that's kind of the attitude you typically get from countries that find themselves in a complex situation power-wise.
Okay, great. That was a great observation. I think I also agree that instead of just trying to recognize the relative power, I think how you also mentioned about China having a reference point, a sort of a target to achieve, and then eventually slipping away from that target, and that's the kind of the generating pressure upon the political leader to take action. To go back to your Brown Sensei's framework, I think many China experts have pointed out that China's current preferred strategy toward Taiwan is a sort of a combination of military coercion with information operation. And everybody's worried about when the Chinese leader might, decide to resort to force. And nobody knows when that might happen. But I think you made a very compelling case about, two structural factors, economic stagnation combined with strategic encirclement, generating a sort of a risk-acceptant behavior on the part of the Chinese leader. And this could compel China to run through the military window of opportunity. I was wondering, how the Taiwan factor would play into this whole picture. The Taiwan is going to have a presidential election next January, and if we have another DPP leader, that means that U.S. support for Taiwanese defense buildup is going to continue. And although it has been sort of lagging until now, it could become more effective, right? And I wonder how that would appear in the eyes of the Chinese leader. Does it have a sort of a accelerated shrinking effect of this military window of opportunity and try to generate more pressure for him to take action? Or do you think this factor is sort of out of the calculus? I wonder how you would see this issue. Yeah.
I think it's a really important issue, although I think the mechanism is maybe a little bit simpler than it may seem with respect to sort of U.S. support for Taiwan's defense reforms. I think Xi Jinping's preference clearly is to get unification without war, right? And so he's using a combination of, as you pointed out, information operations, military coercion, short of war, to try to create a sense of danger, a sense of sort of hopelessness in Taiwan, and to try to reorient the trajectory of Taiwanese politics toward a more accommodating posture that ultimately leads to unification that is coerced but peaceful. So from my perspective, things will become quite dangerous when Xi Jinping realizes or concludes that that strategy is not working or that it has failed. And the reason this becomes very relevant is that we're nearing the next Taiwanese presidential election. Judging from the polls right now, the DPP has poll position. It's in the lead. And if Mr. Lai wins this election, it will be unprecedented in Taiwanese politics. It would be a third consecutive presidential term for the DPP, especially if the KMT performs as poorly as the polls indicate that it will right now. It would indicate that the KMT is not simply failing to win national elections. It would raise the question of whether it's finished as a meaningful opposition party in Taiwanese politics. And that's the sort of development, I think, that could make people in Beijing question whether this coercion strategy is working. And so certainly I would expect to see tensions rise in the Strait if the DPP wins the next election. And it raises the question of whether this might force Xi Jinping to undertake a more searching reevaluation of his strategy. Zach actually made a really interesting point. We were discussing this yesterday, and Zach, I'm going to put words in your mouth now, but you can expand on this. Basically said, you know, Xi Jinping may not like the outcome even if the KMT manages to get it together and win, because the underlying context of Taiwanese politics has shifted so significantly since the last time you had a KMT president there, that even the KMT is not going to be nearly as accommodating of Chinese interests as it might have been a decade ago. And so it may be a case of Xi Jinping gets disappointed now or he gets disappointed later.
Zach, would you like to respond?
Yeah, just to build on that last point and make one other comment. So I think that's right, that actually if the DPP wins, Xi Jinping can still hold out hope that some other party, probably the KMT, will eventually win and that Taiwan will shift approach. I think that a KMT win is really tricky for Beijing, because there could be a feeling that this is the moment that China has to make some progress with Taiwan towards, as the Chinese would say, peaceful reunification. And there might be a lot of pressure in the first year or two of a KMT party to really fix the cross-strait relationship somehow. And I, as Hal said, am guessing that this is not going to be possible to do in the way that the Chinese would want. And I think that disappointment could fracture Beijing's hope for some sort of political solution. And if the KMT doesn't do it and the DPP won't, I think folks in Zhongnanhai might be quite concerned that there is no political future that doesn't require some sort of military action that would unify Taiwan with the mainland. So I agree with that point, Hal. The second thing I would just mention is there's a question about the logic of action in Xi Jinping's mind on Taiwan. I've always been a little bit skeptical that Xi Jinping is going to take action against Taiwan in terms of an invasion out of the blue. I'm guessing that what's more likely is that Xi would feel backed into a corner by actions that Taiwan might take or the US might take, and that he will lash out by taking a military response to show that whatever has been done by Taiwan or the United States has crossed some red line, and that he would act to punish Taiwan in particular in that case. So I think that's more likely as a driver of a major conflict than Xi Jinping feeling that this window of opportunity is closing. I think we have to watch out for both. We can't just hope that he's not going to be triggered by a closing window of opportunity and not be ready. But I actually think the larger risk here is that some action that the United States does or Taiwan does drives Xi to think that actually he has to make some serious response now to close off whatever is happening, and that that's the more risky path towards a conflict.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting because, regardless of the outcome of the Taiwanese election, the Chinese will feel that, Taiwan's slipping away, right, basically. And, your point about U.S. crossing the red line, what do you think could possibly be that sort of triggering action? One could come up with a story saying that, continued and larger scale arms sale from U.S. to Taiwan. Do you think there's a tipping point for China to think that, they could no longer tolerate this kind of effective Taiwanese defense buildup, and they might institute some sort of blockade around Taiwan? That's been a sort of a scenario, right? And you can easily imagine China using this as a pretext, as a way to sort of shield off Taiwan from the rest of the world. I wonder if you have any ideas about, what that red line could be. I'd appreciate that, yeah.
I think the Chinese are actually pretty clear about some of the things that they would see as red lines. The problem is that they're also making the same threats about other things that they, I think, don't really believe are red lines. So the things that I would feel pretty confident on the Chinese side would trigger at least a debate about using force. A formal recognition of independence by Taiwan or by the United States of Taiwan independence, I think that would quite clearly cross China's red line. I think if the United States formally rejected its one China policy, that might get there. And let's be clear, there's some American politicians who've gone to Taipei, including a former Secretary of State, and basically suggested this. I don't think arms sales cross that red line. I think if we put large numbers of U.S. troops in uniform in large units on Taiwan, that might cross the red line. But I think selling arms to Taiwan does not, because that's gone on, frankly, since the 70s. So I think we have a pretty good sense of some of the things that would cross the red line. I actually think here part of the problem is that Beijing has been very inconsistent in how it's tried to message its red lines. Because, last week it appeared that Lai Ching-te going on a transit through the United States was a red line. And Nancy Pelosi going to Taiwan is a red line. So they've sort of drawn so many red lines that you can't tell what's what. And there's a famous saying, which is that if you draw enough red lines, you've created a red carpet to walk down. And I think this is sort of what the Chinese are doing. They've drawn so many red lines, and we know that many of them are not real, that actually the United States can't really tell which red lines are serious and which are not.
Yeah, great point. But one of the, I guess, the risk is we thought that it was a false red line, and we could sort of progress, and at one point there's change in circumstances in China that it has become a real red line, and that's where we have to be very vigilant about, how to respond to Taiwan. Okay, so... But under those circumstances, so we have to be careful not to cross the red lines and also institute effective deterrence, as you mentioned. I think the six requirements are very convincing. And when we talk about deterrence, capabilities and intentions. And on the capability side, a lot of experts, including the U.S. And also the U.S. government, has been talking about China's growing nuclear arsenal, right, the nuclear part. This is a very general question, but what role do you think nuclear weapons will play in the event of a Taiwan crisis? Some people have talked about nuclear blackmail to deter U.S. conventional intervention. Other people have said that China will only use nuclear weapons or threaten to use nuclear weapons when they are sort of called in after undertaking conventional conflict. So if you have any thoughts on that, appreciate that.
Sure. So I would say that the first
thing we should all keep in mind in thinking about the role that nuclear weapons would play in a conflict over Taiwan is that nuclear weapons profoundly shape wars, even when they're not used in the traditional sense. No one has fired off a nuke in Ukraine, and yet the contours of that war have absolutely been shaped by both the Russian nuclear arsenal and the U.S. nuclear arsenal. The Russian nuclear arsenal has deterred the United States from intervening directly in Ukraine, as well as deterring the United States from providing certain capabilities to Ukraine that we fear might be escalatory, longer-range missiles, for instance. The U.S. nuclear arsenal has helped deter Russia from trying to take a more coercive posture towards the countries in Eastern Europe that are keeping Ukraine alive by providing munitions, by turning Poland into a giant logistical base for the Ukrainian resistance, and otherwise essentially being accomplices to Ukraine in a significant war, in a war that has taken the lives of tens of thousands of Russian soldiers. So both sides are effectively coercing each other with nuclear weapons. Okay, so that's just kind of an analytical point or a methodological point. I think nuclear weapons would play a profound role in a U.S.-China conflict from the outset in a few different ways. First, it is hard to come up with any explanation of China's nuclear buildup that doesn't have relevance to a Taiwan conflict. The most benign interpretation of the buildup is that China wants to take away from the United States the ability to threaten nuclear escalation in a Taiwan conflict because the United States would no longer be able to limit the damage that it suffers if China retaliates with nuclear weapons. The slightly less benign interpretation is that the Chinese might make nuclear coercive threats of their own to try to prevent the United States from intervening conventionally in the conflict to begin with. You know, as I mentioned, this is certainly part of the Russian playbook. The Chinese have been a bit more circumspect in discussing the role they think nuclear weapons would play in a Taiwan conflict, but they're certainly developing the sorts, the type of arsenal you might want if that was what you were trying to do. And I actually worry that the United States has gotten itself into a little bit of a predicament with the way that it has responded to the Ukraine war. I'm not necessarily critiquing the response. I think the response has been prudent and in many ways effective. But the message that the United States has explicitly sent, I mean, the president has said this in so many words, is that the reason the United States won't fight in Ukraine, the reason it won't intervene directly, is because Russia has a big nuclear arsenal and it would lead to World War III if the United States and NATO were to get directly involved. If you were Xi Jinping and you took the lesson from that, that the United States simply won't go to war against a nuclear-armed great power, you might be wrong, but you wouldn't be crazy to draw that conclusion. I think the Biden administration has been trying very hard to make Xi Jinping think that Ukraine and Taiwan are different, the circumstances would be different, the United States would intervene if China launched an unprovoked assault. But again, you know, Xi Jinping might believe that America's actions in Ukraine speak louder than its words about Taiwan. And so I think the United States faces a real challenge there. The last thing I'll say about this is I think, you know, even if the United States were to intervene conventionally, China's growing nuclear arsenal will constrain that response, at least at first. And so the clear preference of U.S. policymakers, if they feel that they have to fight a conflict with Taiwan in the Western Pacific, will be to leave the mainland of China alone as much as possible for fear of provoking a nuclear response, either because the Chinese regard that as crossing a red line or because perhaps you think you're going after conventional missile assets or command and control and you're actually going after nuclear assets and command and control. I think that restriction would have to give way fairly quickly because I think it would actually be very difficult for the United States to prevail in a Taiwan conflict if it gave China a sanctuary so close to the battlefield. But there would certainly be a degree of caution injected into the U.S. approach to warfighting by the existence of this increasingly large and diverse Chinese arsenal.
Great. I think one of the challenges of trying to avert intra-conflict escalation is that it will become protracted, right? It's going to take longer to achieve political objectives by the use of force. And I think from a Japanese perspective, that is pretty nightmarish because we are the ones, and probably Taiwan is going to suffer a lot of casualties. So sustaining a so-called defense denial or any strategy of denial is going to have sustain significant cost to the frontline states, I think. And even though the United States may have the sort of the perseverance, endurance, and sustainability to continue that conflict, I think it's going to depend a lot on the frontline states like Japan and also Taiwan as well. So, but moving on to this other element of deterrence about intentions, I want to get to this issue about public resolve, right? I forgot it was maybe Chicago Council opinion survey that they asked about, you know, possible U.S. response to Chinese invasion of Taiwan. And I think only 40% of the people said, you know, it's U.S. should send troops to Taiwan to defend Taiwan. I haven't really seen a similar poll for Japan. And, you know, the trick question is that you have to put this precondition there. Are you willing to risk your life to defend Taiwan? And I haven't seen that kind of framing of the question yet. But I think it's pretty high. My guess is that it's pretty high. A lot of people in Japan would not, you know, respond positively to the idea of getting into a military, full-scale military conflict with China. So public resolve needs to be there in order to, you know, make all these deterrence capabilities credible, right? And yet we don't have that. So we have to shape public opinion and sort of generate awareness about the strategic significance of Taiwan. I was wondering, you know, how you two would explain to the American public about the strategic significance of Taiwan, to what extent the United States should, you know, bear costs and risks to defend Taiwan. And I know, you know, many policymakers have explained this in Congress and other places, but from your perspective, what kind of explanation would be most convincing to the American public when it comes to the defense of Taiwan and the strategic significance of Taiwan? If you have any thoughts on that, I appreciate it.
I'm happy to take a crack at it. The first thing I'll say is that I think the U.S. has gotten itself into a bind in terms of making the case that Taiwan matters, because traditionally we would expect, you know, the president or high-ranking administration officials to be explaining in a public way why Taiwan really matters to the United States, if it's even conceivable that the United States and its allies are basically going to fight World War III over Taiwan. But of course, that's not happening at all. And the reason, I think, is that the administration is worried that giving that sort of speech, engaging in that sort of public education campaign, would simply ratchet tensions higher. It would make the Chinese nervous about, you know, changes in U.S. policy, and it might have the effect of, you know, bringing about the very conflict you seek to avoid. I think the administration is probably a little bit too skittish on this, but I think the dilemma is real. And so the Biden administration is a little bit stuck on this issue right now. The second point I would make is that for the United States, at least, the issue of political will, at least in the early going, depends heavily on how the conflict begins, right? And so if you're talking about a Chinese blockade that looks mostly like a customs quarantine or something like that, where the stick behind it are mostly shore-based missiles and other assets, and then you put the question to Americans, do you want to fight over Taiwan? I think you do run into some of these challenges. If the war starts with kind of the nightmare scenario, which is, you know, the surprise Chinese missile attack, not just on Taiwan, but on U.S. bases in the Western Pacific, many of which are located in Japan, of course, political will in the United States is not going to be a problem, at least in the near term. I mean, you'll have other problems, but that won't be the problem. It may become a problem if the war goes on and it's not clear what objectives the United States is fighting for and so on and so forth, but there's less of a problem generating the consensus at this point. In terms of the sort of appeals that would work in terms of convincing Americans of the value of Taiwan, a lot of times we will focus, and if you ask me what's most important about Taiwan, I would give you, you know, an answer that only professors and students of strategic studies can love, right? And talk about Taiwan's position in the first island chain and how it's crucial to the balance of power in the Western Pacific and so on and so forth. And those arguments are very important, both analytically and in terms of generating popular support. But values-based arguments are often the arguments that resonate most strongly with the American people. Arguments that, you know, and it could be an argument that you simply don't want to live in the sort of world where big, bad authoritarian states can invade small, vulnerable democracies on their borders. These are the sorts of things that Americans tend to get excited about. And if you look at, you know, the initial support for Ukraine after February 2022, it has a lot to do with this narrative of this plucky democracy that's trying to survive against this aggressive authoritarian regime next door. And so I think any successful appeal to mobilize American support for Taiwan, whether in peacetime or wartime, is going to have to blend these two elements because it's that package that's persuasive to Americans.
Just to build on that last point from Hao, which I very much agree with, I think basically there are four reasons that the U.S. might care about Taiwan. First, there is the economic relationship between the U.S. and Taiwan, something like the 10th largest two-way trade partner. Second, there's Taiwan's technology role as the provider of semiconductors for just about everything that's advanced that we use in the world. Third, as Hao said, there's the strategic argument about Taiwan's geostrategic position. And then fourth, there's the values argument, right? Taiwan is this flourishing democracy. The problem I think we have is that none of those four is convincing on its own, right? So, you know, there are lots of democracies that the U.S. doesn't fight for, that, you know, this administration didn't fight in Afghanistan. They wanted to get out. So that's not a reason on its own. Taiwan being a tech leader isn't a reason on its own because at the end of the day, you can get a candidate like Vivek Ramaswamy who said the other day, oh, well, no problem. We'll just build our own microchips and then we don't have to fight for Taiwan in a couple of years. So I think each of these arguments is only partially persuasive. And that's the real issue is that there's no single answer. And so I think Americans are sort of struggling with this. They feel generally like Taiwan is important for some of these reasons, but there's not one thing that convinces them that absolutely we have to be there for Taiwan.
Okay, great. So we have about maybe 25 minutes or so. So I'm going to introduce some questions from the floor, if that's okay. So let me see. I have one question for Dr. Brands. What does Dr. Brands feel Japan needs to do to contribute to his six requirements to deter China? So you don't have to go through all six, but you know, if you have any thoughts on some of the elements here.
You can't accuse me of playing to the hometown crowd when I say this, but I think Japan is basically doing what it needs to do, at least on the time frame that we're talking about. In fact, it's hard to identify any U.S. ally that is more dramatically changing the way it does business with an eye to, among other things, the possibility of a contingency in the Western Pacific than Japan is. And if you think about the components of a successful denial defense, it's going to involve finding ways of, fielding a lot of anti-ship missiles that you can use to turn the Western Pacific into a no-go zone for Chinese vessels. It's going to involve finding ways of operating from a larger number of smaller bases and facilities rather than just a handful of relatively large, concentrated, vulnerable outposts. It's going to involve finding ways of, you know, augmenting the capabilities the U.S. can bring to bear with those of other important nations. And in all of those areas, Japan was already an important actor, and it's becoming an even more important actor right now. And in fact, I think a lot of the things that are happening in terms of turning the Southwestern Islands into strong points, in terms of, you know, thinking about how Japan can cooperate with the United States on sort of an archipelagic defense, in terms of thinking about how the two countries can cooperate to maintain a favorable undersea balance, Japan is basically doing what the United States would ask it to do. I could come up with things that in an ideal world one might ask Japan to do more of, but the fact is Japan is doing more, and more importantly, it's moving faster on these issues than basically any other country out there. And so, and I think it'd probably be fairer to turn the question around and say, you know, what does Japan need the United States to do to show that it's serious about these issues?
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. This is this question I'd like to direct to both Kupa-san and Brand-sensei. I'm sure you've gotten this before, but it's a generic question. Is there value to reducing strategic ambiguity and setting red lines and saying explicitly, yep, we will break blockades, we will fight for Taiwan's autonomy? So if you have any questions on that, comments on that, appreciate it.
So I think this is a really important question, but I think the framing is a little bit wrong. So strategic ambiguity, first, it's not the way that American government leaders describe our policy, but it's the way that people understand it. The reality, however, is that there is no binary choice between strategic ambiguity and strategic clarity. This is a spectrum. And where we are on this spectrum has already shifted, because President Biden has now said 4 times that he would defend Taiwan. So the idea that we have a policy of strategic ambiguity and over here, and there's a policy of strategic clarity over here, that's not right. We're actually somewhere in the middle already. I think a full policy of strategic clarity doesn't make any sense. And the reason Americans should remember this is that we thought about having a policy of strategic clarity on Taiwan back when the US had a mutual defense treaty with Taiwan, and this was really hard for a lot of reasons. For example, which islands are you going to be strategically clear that you're defending, right? If you remember, some islands were covered in the US-Taiwan mutual defense treaty, right? So the Pongus were covered. Others were not. And it turns out that the ones that were not covered were the ones that were attacked, which is kind of always the way this goes, as any student of the Korean War will remember. So I think the problem for advocates of strategic clarity is that at the end of the day, the second you start drawing these red lines, you get into big problems. So if you include Matsu, there's no way the US can defend it. So the Chinese can just challenge that. If you don't include Kimoi Matsu, then the Chinese are probably going to challenge you there anyways. So there's no right answer if you have a strategically clear approach. So I think we need some degree of ambiguity. I think the problem is not with the policy that we have, it's with the messaging of the policy. Because to Americans and to many others, strategic ambiguity just sounds like weakness. And it's confusing, and people don't understand it. So my view is that we actually need to reframe American policy to not change it, but to change the way we message it. And that there are some better options. The phrasing I like is something like dynamic deterrence. The basic idea being that we are on this spectrum of ambiguity to clarity, but where we are on that spectrum should shift as China's pressure increases. So if China increases the pressure on Taiwan, that we have to increase our deterrent posture. But our objective is the same. Our objective is still peace and stability. It's still the status quo. So I think reframing the policy would be beneficial so that we can explain to our people and our friends what the logic of our approach is. But I think the idea that we should actually fundamentally change strategic ambiguity by embracing strategic clarity just doesn't really make a lot of sense.
So I agree with Zach, although for a slightly different reason, which is that I think the debate over strategic clarity is a little bit beside the point, in the sense that if the United States has not already convinced Xi Jinping that it would defend Taiwan through the statements that President Biden has made, then shifting to strategic clarity isn't going to do the trick, right? There will be some deeper reason he doesn't believe us about this issue. And so if I have to, you know, choose between expending time and effort on sort of America's perceived commitment to Taiwan or on the capabilities that are required to make that commitment good, I think it's actually the capabilities that are the real challenge that the United States faces. And in fact, I would be a little bit wary of strategic clarity because it gets back to a point that Zach made a few minutes ago. In my view, the things that really trigger Beijing are not, you know, the question of whether there are 30 or 40 American military personnel on the island or what's in the arms sale package. It's things that appear to change Taiwan's political status in a meaningful way, right? This is why, you know, the visit of Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan is triggering for China in the way that the sale of anti-ship missiles is not. And so you would have to be prepared to accept a significant degree of blowback because it would look to Beijing like the United States was significantly altering the status quo in the Strait. So I will make one exception to the point I just made, though, which is that one area where I think strategic clarity of a sort, and I'll explain what I mean here, would be helpful is when it has more of a multilateral cast to it. And so one of the ideas I've sometimes pushed sort of as a stretch goal is I think it would be helpful if the U.S., Japan, and Australia were to issue a declaration saying that they would treat an attack on any one of them as an attack on all three. Doesn't have to mention Taiwan, right? All three countries have reasons for not wanting to do that vis-a-vis Taiwan. It's solely about an attack on the United States, Australia, or Japan. Obviously, the United States already has alliance commitments with Australia and Japan. Australia and Japan have an increasingly close strategic relationship, which if you read the strategic declaration that was put out in the fall of 2022, has some sort of alliance-light-like language on, you know, consulting, on a joint response to regional security crises and things like that. But the reality is that since I think it would actually be very difficult for China to pull off an attack on Taiwan without attacking the United States, Japan, or both at the same time, this would essentially serve as more of a multilateral warning that a war against Taiwan is likely to turn into a big regional war that's likely larger than China wants to fight.
Great point. I've also been pitching this idea about U.S., Japan, and Australia having a 2+2+2 framework to, you know, issue a joint statement and undertaking, you know, federated defense efforts to sort of message to China that arms buildup will be, you know, negated by multilateral balancing. And so there's a lot of things that the three countries can do, and we'll probably have to come up with good ideas from now on. Okay, so, Zach, if I may go back to your original point about the shift in the international order. You talked about, you know, shift from unipolarity to multipolarity, alliances to alignment, and multilateralism to minilateralism. Do you think this shift, this is a vague term, but is it going to have a more stabilized, are we likely to have a more stabilizing world as a result of this? You know, U.S. and China will obviously face this kind of pressure to, you know, to face a conflict, but if the third parties sort of move towards a sort of a strategic autonomy type of position, and they try to distance themselves from the two powers, because they all know that even if you have a Taiwan conflict, it's not going to end with an unconditional surrender. They're going to continue to exist, right? So it's not wise for them to take sides. And as a result, they might, you know, stay on the sidelines and sort of weather out this conflict, whatever conflict they have. So we tended to think that, you know, during the Trump administration, you know, the Huawei deal, the world will be divided. But in fact, it's not going to be divided, right? Other third countries will probably take their own position as a result of this multipolarity shift and, you know, avoiding red lines, avoiding treaty commitments and so forth. So is that going to be a sort of a stabilizing effect? We used to think that great power relationship will define the general direction of international or global politics, but is it going to be the reverse, meaning that the third countries might have a sort of a stabilizing effect and make the great powers think twice about, you know, how they should behave? I was wondering what you think about that.
Yeah, it's such an interesting question, Satoru. I've never thought of it in quite that way. I guess my instinct is that the world might be less stable but more secure. So let me try and tear that apart a little bit. So I think the reality is it will be less stable because you will have much more flexibility in arrangements. And, you know, political scientists know that bipolar systems tend to be the most stable systems because they change the least, because countries don't have a lot of options, right? You're either on one side or the other, or maybe you're non-aligned, but, you know, the room for non-alignment is more limited in a bipolar system. So I think the reality is a multipolar system is much less stable. You're going to have countries shifting sides. I mean, frankly, they may be playing multiple sides at the same time. The question is, though, whether that makes the world less secure. And I'm not sure that it does. I think you could have third parties sort of shifting sides more frequently and still have a pretty secure system in the sense that the likelihood of actual conflict may not go up, in part because it's not necessarily, as you were saying, a winner-take-all competition at that point. That, you know, and this is the big debate. Hal and I have been working on this for years. This is the big debate in the United States and I think elsewhere about what the U.S.-China competition is, if that's even the right term. Some people say, oh, it's a competition of systems, right? Joe Biden says in the outset of his national security strategy that we're in this competition and we're in it to win. Okay, so that sounds like one side wins, the other side loses. I think in a multipolar system, though, the idea of sort of winning and losing is much less clear. And it's not as clear that this is an existential challenge. So my guess is that the system itself will be much less stable. It will change much more. But it could be more secure because it may be less existential ultimately.
Thank you very much. So going back to some of the questions from the participant, from the audience. Let me see. I have one question from an LDP member. This has to do with supply chain and technology. This is sort of a different topic that we're shifting topics. Can US, Taiwan, Japan, and other allies do a joint cooperation on enhancing supply chain resiliencies, specifically on semiconductor and batteries as eco investments? I'm not quite sure what this eco investment means, but it's going to depend a lot on individual countries' interests, but if you have any thoughts on that, you know, generally speaking, you know, how do you, what kind of functional cooperation would be possible in this kind of high-tech sector? Yeah, if you have any thoughts on that.
Just briefly, maybe. I think that, yes, it's important, but the difficulty of doing it varies dramatically across different technologies and different supply chains. And so one of the reasons that the Biden administration chose to focus so heavily on semiconductors in their first year and a half or so in office was that the, you know, the supply chain or the value chain is dominated by about five countries in the world, four maybe, and, you know, they are all close U.S. allies or security partners. And so if you're thinking about imposing costs on China or simply investing in the resilience of that supply chain, it's relatively easy because you or friendly countries already have a very strong position. It's much more difficult if you think about EV batteries or other forms of renewable energy, because in many cases, China actually has a very strong position. And so if you are thinking about focusing on supply chain resilience, it's a larger hill to climb, and you are more susceptible to coercion from China or retaliation or whatever the case may be. And so I think that this is one reason why we've seen the administration's technology initiatives clustered in the areas that they have been, because the answers are just much harder when you get into supply chains that are distributed either over across a larger number of countries or where you're going in position is just weaker to begin with.
Just to build briefly on what Hal was saying, I think the real challenge here is in the United States, and it's a domestic political challenge, right? The Biden team has been, I think, in general, very good on allies and partners, except for one area, which is trade. And in trade, they're basically protectionist. And we've seen, whether it's the Inflation Reduction Act or other pieces of legislation, whereas my view is that we should be friendshoring, as Janet Yellen would say, and that actually the best way to have resilience is not just to rely on your own country, but to rely on a small or maybe even a large group of friends who you can really trust. I think the Biden team believes in Buy America. And so I think the logic of friendshoring makes a ton of sense. The politics in the United States are much more difficult. So I wish the answer to that question was yes, but I'm not sure that it would be in the current administration.
I just wanted to raise in this context of tech competition about export control. I think until now, U.S. Department of Commerce, Bureau of Industrial Security has been, making these decisions rather unilaterally, right? And requesting U.S. allies to, follow suit and coordinate so that they don't do backfilling, right? If the United States were to sort of request the U.S. allies not to backfill, I think it's better if they involve these U.S. allies before making the actual decision to, put what companies on the entity list and so forth. So I strongly feel that this kind of consultation should take place during maybe a democratic administration that's more focused on multilateralism. But I hope there's some progress on that front. I think we only have about 5 minutes, so we'd like to move to the concluding comments, if you have any other thoughts on our remaining issues. But to sort of, you don't have to respond to this, but I want to make my own comments and with regard to Taiwan contingency. And it's to do with sort of a current Japanese atmosphere. We finished this brilliant series of strategic documents last December, National Security Strategy, National Defense Strategy, and the defense buildup plan. I think a lot of, most of the homeworks have been taken care of by those documents, and I think all the efforts that are outlined in those documents should be undertaken with full steam. And I'm pretty confident that they will undertake with this 5-year time frame and the 10-year time frame, right? But having heard Brand Sensei's discussion about the risks of possibly maybe a deterrence failure in the late 2020s. There's a risk, right? If we don't do enough, China might feel confident to take action. If that ever happens, do we have a theory of victory? And, US leader, US president, and the Japanese prime minister is going to ask their subordinates, if we get into this crisis and get into a conflict with China, what is our exit strategy? How are we going to prevail? And if everything's ambiguous, saying, this is going to turn into a protracted conflict, will they make the decision to get involved in that kind of crisis? And I fear that, theoretically speaking, I hope they don't make that decision, but political leaders can rationalize and say, well, this is not the right time to fight, and we can redraw the line and, think about future possibilities. I think that's disastrous. I hope it doesn't come to that. But if that kind of, if we don't have a theory of victory, that's the kind of very difficult situation we might be cornered into. And so before realizing everything in the documents come to, as you mentioned, if before they are delivered and we face a crisis, how are we going to deal with that? And if we don't have a plan for that, it's going to be hard for any political leaders to make a confident decision. They will be the ones to sort of assume the risks, and we have to come up with new ideas about how to respond, not deter, but respond when we are not fully prepared for that conflict. That's the kind of new debate that we have to have, I think, both in Washington and Tokyo. So if you have any concluding thoughts about any of the topics that we raised or any other issues that you want to raise, please do.
Sure. I think that comment is very well taken. I'll just say a couple things very, very quickly. I think in theory, it's easy to identify a theory of victory in a conflict with China over Taiwan, which is that, you try to turn back the attempt to conquer Taiwan, and then you make peace on the status quo, basis of the status quo ante. In reality, that's just not how great power wars work historically. They sprawl, they escalate, they intensify, war aims expand until countries get tired of fighting, and then they come back. And so I just think it comes back to the point that I made at the beginning, that once the shooting starts, all of the options are terrible. And so this brings me back to maybe a point that Zach made earlier. All of the discussion about timelines sometimes creates the impression that there's like a big red clock in Xi Jinping's office that's ticking down to zero, and when it hits zero, he's just going to invade Taiwan. And that's obviously not the way it works, right? What happens is you get a context in which a leader becomes more risk acceptant, and then something happens, a crisis breaks out, the United States does something, Taiwan does something that makes him think that waiting is worse than not waiting. But it's actually not a bad idea for us to act as though there is a clock ticking down to zero, because that's the only way that I think we will generate the urgency to get ahead of some of these challenges. And to Zach's point that the U.S.-China competition is much broader than the Taiwan issue, and that Taiwan or even what's been happening in Washington, Beijing may not be the center of gravity, I think that's right. What I would just say is that Taiwan is not the only thing that matters in the U.S.-China competition, but if we get it wrong, it's the thing that's going to be the hardest to recover from because the consequences would be catastrophic.
The one comment I want to make is just how remarkable this discussion is. 5 years ago, if we had tried to have this discussion in a public forum on Taiwan issues, it would have been close to impossible, I think. I mean, we've got brilliant scholars here in the room. Even in private, frankly, having a very detailed U.S. discussion with Japan on Taiwan would have been incredibly hard. And that's saying something because, the U.S. and Japan, from an American's perspective, share far more interests on this issue, on China, than any other country around the world. I don't think it's even close. So it's quite remarkable to me how fast we've moved. Now, I want to be clear. I think most of the credit goes to Japan, right? Japan has taken a whole series of actions in the last few years that are incredibly ambitious. So I think we are moving very fast and responding to, the danger zone that Hao's mentioning. But this is where I'll leave it. I think the real challenge is we may be moving fast enough to win a war. I'm not sure that we're moving fast enough to be able to deter a war. In other words, if we've learned anything from watching Vladimir Putin blunder into a major conflict, it's that sometimes winning the war is actually easier than preventing the war from happening, because convincing an autocrat that their military isn't as good as they think it is incredibly hard. And so I think part of the challenge that we have, as Hal's noted, is not just whether we have the capabilities to win, but how we communicate that to Xi Jinping. And on that issue, I think we still have a huge amount of work to do.
はい、ありがとうございました。ちょうど、時間が6時になりましたので、本日大変90分でしたけれども充実した先生方 のご議論を伺うことができました。最後に大変恐縮ですけれども、ブランズ先生とクーパーさんに拍手をよろしくお願いいたします。